Welcome to Krasnoyarsk in the heart of Siberia. Winter has transformed the region's mountains, forests and lakes into a thrill-seeker's paradise. So join us in this adrenaline-fueled episode to see how the people here keep warm. And I'll tell you what, I'm going to join them because it's absolutely freezing.
First activity is free riding.
Доброе утро.
Nice to meet you.
Да,
очень приятно.
Отлично, да.
Помните.
Victor, what makes Pskovoye the freeride capital of Russia? Why is it so special?
It must be the will of the Almighty that here in the north of Khakassia, specifically in Pskovoye, snow arrives early. There's snow on the slopes around Pskovoye as early as late September. Starting in October and all through November, Pskovoye gets a lot of powdery snow. Powder is manna from heaven for freeriders, extreme skiers and snowmobile enthusiasts.
So what's the main difference between skiing on this sort of powdered snow here compared to a groomed slope in like a ski resort or something?
A carefully groomed slope is very different, of course. You know where you're going. You know what to expect. Free riding is different. You have a guide who gives you certain directions, and then there's only you against the slope. How you negotiate it depends entirely on you. When you're free riding, you are, on the one hand, on your own, but on the other, there's a team keeping an eye on you. It's teamwork. You can't free ride alone.
So what's the biggest piece of advice that you give to beginners before they start a free ride?
My main piece of advice would be to provide feedback on physical condition. Exercise, improve your technique, train on prepared slopes, and once it gets boring for you, welcome to free riding.
What's the most important thing? Is it strong legs? Is it cardio system? Balance, or is it all together?
It's all together. Cardio, strong legs, strong arms, and so on. You need to be in shape, definitely. You can be up to your eyebrows in snow while free riding, so you'll have to be ready for new and challenging situations. It's not every day we get conditions like that, but still, if you hit a deep powder patch, you'll need to work with different muscle groups, so you'd be well advised to come prepared and in good physical shape.
Well, do you think I'm ready to give it a try?
You seem ready.
Okay, well, let's do it then.
Well, I tried and completely failed to take on these incredible slopes myself, so unfortunately, I can't tell you anything about the thrill of free riding. So let's catch up with someone who can.
Victor, I've just come down a mixture of skiing, but mostly falling and walking. My heart's still racing, I'm covered in snow, and I'm still exhausted. I probably made all the mistakes beginners make out on the slopes. What are the mistakes that I made today?
A key rookie mistake in freeriding is being afraid. Afraid of the new sensations, new landscapes, and deep powder. During your first descent, try to at least get used to this kind of snow, and use the technique you developed on groomed slopes to get down off-piste the best way you can. Your biggest mistake was tilting your body forward too much, and lifting your outside ski when changing edges. That's why the tip of your outside ski kept getting caught in the snow and you fell to the side when turning. Overall, you got a grip on the powder towards the end of our descent, but you were so exhausted by then that you didn't have enough strength left to even get back on your skis. You literally walked the last stretch. You were on your last legs, as they say.
Yeah, I hardly made it back. Now, in ski resorts, they obviously monitor for avalanches, but here, we're basically out on our own. How do you keep yourself safe in such conditions?
It's true, there's always the danger of avalanches in the mountains around Pryskovoye, so we conduct drills on a regular basis to stay prepared. We have briefings, intro classes on preparedness, etc. And we avoid avalanche-prone areas when we go out with beginners. We take them to slopes that are less steep and less likely to produce avalanches. In theory, though, any slope with an angle of more than 10 or 15 degrees is considered a risk. However, there are safer slopes with gentle angles, a deep snowpack, and a lot of trees that can catch the snow, and that's where we take beginners.
Phew. And have you ever had any hairy moments yourself when it comes to avalanches?
Of course I have. I was still a school kid at the time, and we didn't know much. Back then, we didn't have avalanche sensors. But here I am, talking to you, alive and well. Those accidents taught us some very important lessons.
And what's the main thing you should do if you end up in an avalanche?
If you get caught in an avalanche, the key thing is to keep afloat. A person drowning in the river will try to stay on the surface any way they can. The same thing applies. If you don't have an avalanche airbag, try to stay on the surface. If you feel you're getting sucked in, cover your nose and mouth. This is key. And most importantly, wait to be rescued by those who know what to do and will come to your aid very soon.
My sensor's here as well.
Yes, you have an avalanche sensor, a beeper that alerts you. The other members of your team also have these sensors, which can receive your signal. And they'll come looking for you as quickly as possible.
Do free riders here have any sort of rituals or traditions that they perform before they hit the slopes?
We all have our own rituals. Some say a prayer, because free riding is still a dangerous sport, no matter what. Every descent can be dangerous. You need to stay focused and alert. Here in the backcountry, you're on your own. So we do have rituals and traditions. We appease mountain spirits in our Khakas tradition. We pour them a little liqueur and leave bits of bread and meat, even sandwiches sometimes, which are then eaten by crows and small animals such as sables. This is how we appease the spirits, through wildlife.
I accidentally put on two right socks this morning. Maybe that's why I was so bad on the slopes.
I doubt it.
Well, thank you so much for your help on the slope, Victor. I wouldn't have made it without you. Спасибо вам за помощь на склоне.
My pleasure. Out in the vast openness, we're one team. There's no one to help us except each other.
Next, we head to what locals call the Krasnoyarsk Sea. It's a frozen reservoir where snow kiters harness the power of the wind to glide effortlessly across the ice.
Dimitri, I've heard of kite surfing, obviously. Bit of a naive question now. Is snow kiting basically the same, but on snow?
Look, Peter, both are essentially types of sailing, windsurfing, kitesurfing, and even yachting. It's a wind-driven sport, a sport where you wrestle nature, where you wrestle with the wind.
Now, I see it combines elements of kiting, skiing, some people use snowboards. Does experience in those sports help with snow kiting?
You're right, Peter. If you want to be good at snow kiting, you need to feel confident standing on skis, or on a snowboard, or even on your own 2 feet. Then you have to get familiar with the kite and finally combine the skills of riding your apparatus, be it skis or a snowboard, and handling the kite. The kite is really a hybrid. It functions both as a wing and a sail. That's why you need to start by practicing skiing or snowboarding, and then learn how to handle the kite before bringing it all together.
Well, can you show me how you control the kite with the skis? How do you change direction with the wind and change your speed as well?
Controlling the kite is quite simple, but like driving a car, it requires some skill. This is the control bar. It's connected to these lines, each of which can hold up to 150 kilograms. The flying lines in the middle can hold up to 200 to 300 kilograms. As you can see, they won't break, even if the kite lifts us up in the air. If you want your kite to go somewhere, you need to move the control bar. It's not like a steering wheel in a car, so rotating it won't help. It's more like the handlebars on a bicycle. Pull on the left, and the kite flies left. If you pull on the right, it'll fly right. But that's not the end of the story. You can also push the bar away from you, or pull it towards you, which changes the kite's angle of attack. Here, the kite should be thought of as a wing. When the control bar is farthest from you, the angle of attack is minimal, which means the power is at its lowest. If you want to give it more power, we begin to pull the bar towards ourselves. So this is how it works. The kite is controlled by combining all these operations.
And how long does it take for a beginner to become competent at snow kiting?
On average, it takes between 40 to 90 minutes to become competent at snow kiting. But that doesn't mean you'll instantly become a competitive kite surfer. You'll just have the skills that will allow you to move around in some way. Snow kiting includes many different disciplines, from course racing to acrobatics. And as in any sailing sport, a kite surfer can go either upwind or downwind. We can't travel straight into the wind. That's why we have to zigzag, or what we call tacking. Yes, that's also something you need to learn. It requires a special skill set. You need to develop muscle memory so that controlling the kite comes as naturally to you as driving a car. And you don't ask yourself what you should do in any given situation. You just automatically do the right thing.
Part of your body.
As if it's a part of your body, yes. You're right. This equipment has been used to compete in the Russian National Championships several times. You saw for yourself how strong its lift is. You jumped on it.
I mean, I saw you, yeah. If
you hold on to me, it'll lift us both.
And the wind isn't even that strong today.
It's not very strong today, but it is gusty, uneven. That's why it's jerking us this way and that. Let's give it a try. Put your hands over mine. Yep, now look at the kite. We need to push this thing a little bit. There it goes. Now, turn right, then left. I'm now counterbalancing its lift.
Very small movements as well.
Yes. If we push the bar away, we decrease power. If I pull it towards myself, it'll soon pick up power. That's it. It's beginning to pull.
So this is a sports car.
Now you do it. Left.
Left. Sorry.
No, that's okay. Push the control bar away. Decrease power. Now left. Right. Left. Right.
Right.
Left.
Easy.
Well.
Yeah. I'll let you take control now.
It's trying to overtake. Now drop. Left one. Easy there.
Аккуратно. Аккуратненько.
Now wait. Move the bar like this. Wait.
The wind's died a bit.
Left, easy. Right.
So we need to keep it
a few degrees, like this.
Okay.
Right.
You really need to concentrate.
Left. Right. Let's swing it from side to side.
Yeah, there we go.
No, you control it. I'm just holding it. You steer. Like this.
Okay.
Stop. Let go.
Sorry, Dmitry.
No problem. That's okay. I don't even have to look at it. We can keep talking. I just feel it.
Because you feel it, yeah.
It's up there somewhere.
And the kite's just still. Static, yeah.
Because I know where it is. I sense its position with my whole body. I can control it with just two fingers, like this.
And how many years have you been doing this?
21 years.
I've done 21 seconds. About.
It was a learning curve. Mm-hmm. It took years, literally.
And this is a sport kite.
This is a sport kite. Yes, what makes them different is their elongated shape. They're very narrow. Recreational kites look like inflatable floating mats, and they're smaller. This one has a larger surface area. The size of the kite is chosen depending on wind conditions. With a moderate wind like now, a 12 to 15 square meter kite is enough. For stronger winds, you'd need a smaller kite.
How many meters?
Starting from 4 to 5 square meters. And the largest kites have an area of 21 square meters, which is rare.
So there's no wind.
If the wind's too slow, the kite won't fly. It has to have a speed of at least 2 meters per second. That's just to get it off the ground. And it has to be at least 3 meters per second for the kite to start pulling. That sort of range. This is the part that bears most of the load. The center of mass. You're sitting, right? Yes, if you held it with just your hands, you'd be exhausted in 10 minutes.
Is it true that polar explorers use snow kiting as a form of transport?
When you have these vast expanses of snow, why not? The Kola Peninsula in Russia is a snowy wilderness. Because there's so much there, it's a magnet for kitesurfing enthusiasts from all over Russia. People go there to compete and just surf for fun. It's an ocean of snow. As for polar exploration, why not? We don't need much, just a flat surface. Even some gentle hills are okay. And wind. Although there is an extreme kitesurfing variety where athletes surf in the mountains, that's 3D surfing.
Of course.
But you have to think three-dimensionally. There are some daredevils who speed down the slopes of a 200 to 300 meter mountain and glide down on their kite.
Amazing. Amazing. I've not reached that level yet.
That's an interesting experience, though.
What sort of speeds in ideal conditions can you reach while snow kiting?
If I'm not mistaken, the world record is 135 kilometers per hour. But you need an extremely strong wind and a very experienced kite surfer. Also, I believe that record was set on a very flat water surface. Here, we've reached speeds of up to 80 kilometers per hour. We'd put a GPS device here, on the back, to record the top speed. And we did that experiment on the frozen surface of the Krasnoyarsk Reservoir, not on loose snow. 80 kilometers is pretty fast.
I bet, yeah, but it's also quite dangerous, yeah, for those.
Yes, one awkward move and you're over. You need to steer very delicately.
Well, Dmitry, thank you so much for telling me all about snow kiting. It was fascinating. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Sort of Austrian.
Come again. Give this sport a try.
No amount of talking about the dogs and sledding actually prepares you for taking control. I mean, the power and the energy that these dogs have is astounding. And the silence after all the barking is a bit of a relief. What a perfect way to spend the Siberian winter. Zhenya, there are so many dogs here, but they all look so different. Are they all huskies?
We breed working sled dogs. They're all huskies. But not all of them are Siberian huskies like you might see in the cities. In fact, Siberian huskies in Russia have sat around on couches for the past 100 years. So they've lost most of their working qualities.
Right, okay.
There are only a couple of breeding kennels in Russia which have decent, working Siberian huskies. The dogs you see here may look like mutts to you.
I wouldn't say that in front of them. Well, this one's eating, so I think we'll leave him to his food.
Many of our dogs are Alaskan huskies. It's a crossbreed that emerged during the gold rush. It happened by accident, descending from all the breeds that were brought there back in the day. The gold rush was short-lived, though, so Americans ended up with a huge dog population on their hands. Some of those dogs were excellent working dogs, while others were super pretty. The pretty ones were named Siberian huskies.
And this one?
While the working ones kept on, well, working.
Oh. And how do you teach them how to pull a sled, Zhenya?
When I started out in sled dog racing, my dogs weren't pulling very well. I kept asking my older colleagues what I should do to teach them. They told me, just buy better dogs. There's some truth in that, because a true working animal is different in terms of its muscle and bone structure, cooling system, etc. Even the surface area of its tongue matters. And they do have motivation, you just need to make sure not to quash it during training. There are certain nuances about how to steer the sled, turning left or right. If this is what you're asking, the answer is simple again. Just add more experienced dogs to your pack. Or if you don't have experienced animals yet, use standard training techniques. We create situations designed to elicit certain behaviors. We know, for instance, that the dog is about to turn right, so we say, "You're turning right now, well done," and act accordingly.
Do they enjoy it?
We'll harness them and you'll see for yourself.
Oh, well, this one's a very affectionate one.
Yeah.
Now, well, this is a great example because all these dogs here, they seem to be so affectionate and loving. Like, where does this personality trait come from?
This is the result of selective breeding. Sled dogs are supposed to be friendly with people. During a competition, a dog may be pulled from the races at this or that stage due to health issues, so it should respond well to being handled by volunteers or vets. The same applies to indigenous dog sledding. The dad may use the pack in the morning, while the mom and the son may have to go somewhere in a sled in the afternoon or evening. The dogs must be happy to work with all of them.
These sled dogs, like the Siberian Husky, they're famous for their ability to withstand and extremely cold temperatures. How do they do it? Because this one obviously looks like he can withstand very cold temperatures, but some of them, they look like maybe not quite so much.
You know what's funny? I already had this dog and got a few of these bald ones. That's what we call Alaskan Huskies. And when winter temperatures hit, I was very worried about how they would survive the cold. Strange as it may seem, the bald ones did better because their metabolism is different. They converted food to energy very quickly. You have to give them energy-rich food, of course. You know, sled dogs are different from all other dogs. There's a theory. All the dogs we have on this continent, be it working dogs, hunting dogs, or pets, are thought to have been descended from a jackal-like animal, while northern dogs are supposed to be more closely related to wolves. You can see this in their skull and backbone structure, and most importantly, in their digestive system. All indigenous dogs have protein and fat metabolism, while continental dogs have protein and carbohydrate metabolism.
So do you have to feed them different foods then?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Excellent.
Yes.
Zhenya, I've heard it's a real science positioning the dogs in a team. How do you do it?
Lead dogs are key, of course. You could say they are where the magic happens. Some dogs are great leaders with one team, but can be rather unimpressive with another. Normally, you'd have the more powerful dogs closer to the sled because they pull the most weight. There's a myth that only the lead dog steers, while the others just follow. In fact, if the rear dogs also assist in steering, when they hear the command, it makes the ride much smoother and safer.
So what makes a good leader of a team? Is it the strongest, the fastest? Is it like the leader in a pack where the other follow? You said it's magic. How do you determine the lead?
Leaders are defined by how well they can function. They mustn't turn back and must respond promptly to commands. A really awesome leader also turns at the right angle and can even leave the trail and run across snow if necessary. What makes this or that dog in a pack leader material is a bit special. Some dogs do it because they have a partner they love to run with. Others do it for their owner because they enjoy running together and want to please their master. Others just love running. They see it as their job, and it's their greatest happiness in life.
I can tell. So you have the leaders at the front, the stronger dogs at the back. Which dogs do you put in the middle?
Team dogs. They can maintain the overall speed well, keep the gang line straight, and don't get exhausted too quickly by trying to tow harder than the rear dogs. They usually take turns to rest. The key thing is to make sure they don't rest all the time.
And I can see you have a real affection for these dogs, and these dogs really love you. How have you built up that trust and communication?
It's like with any creature, not just dogs, but also people. Okay. The key thing is not to let them down. Well, live up to their expectations.
Okay, that's wise words.
Don't lie to them, etc.
Oh, thank you very much for introducing me to your dog, Shane.